Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.
Nobody has more respect for women than I do. Nobody.
Hillary Clinton wants to abolish it. Believe me. She wants to abolish our Second Amendment.
I think they didn't deny it. I don't think anybody denied it.
Other presidents did not call. They'd write letters, and some presidents didn't do anything.
Many people have come out and said I'm right.
You really do have to ask yourself, where does it stop?
Hello and welcome to Fallacious Trump, the podcast where we use the insane ramblings of a melting hunk of uninformed apricot jello to explain logical fallacies. I'm your host, Jim.
And I'm your other host, Mark. A logical fallacy is an error in reasoning that results in bad or invalid arguments, and the logical fallacy we're looking at this week is the reification fallacy, also known as misplaced concreteness and hypostatization.
So the reification fallacy is, as all Latin scholars will be able to tell immediately...
Exactly, as we know, yeah.
..about making things. So, res, yeah. Thing, facare, making, and it's about making abstract concepts or abstract things into concrete things.
Yeah.
Usually things that have some form of kind of intent or agency or emotion to them.
Like an uninformed apricot jello.
Yeah. Similar to that.
Yeah. There you go.
So this is a kind of thing that is done in literature and film and things like that. And in fact, sometimes just in rhetoric in general, when people are making using metaphors.
Yeah.
Saying something like the sea is angry.
Right. Yeah.
In most cases, the speaker isn't literally saying the sea has the capacity to feel emotions. They're just using it to get the listener to feel a particular thing. And in literature, it's called a pathetic fallacy, which is a weird name because it's neither pathetic nor a fallacy. Both those words have changed meaning over time. So pathetic is being used in terms of pathos, emotion, and the fallacy there is just a falsehood. So you're using a false way of looking at something to invoke emotion.
Is it a bit like also that kind of the personification of animals or concepts, you know, when something is given almost human attributes as part of a Disneyfication of a mouse, for instance? Is that reification or is that
anthropomorphism?
There you go. That's the word I was struggling to find.
Where something is imbued with human attributes. It can be just the normal, acceptable, rhetorical version of this and essentially just metaphorical.
Right.
Where it becomes a logical fallacy is where that is then used to either literally say that this thing is real and has emotions and or intent in some ways, as some of the examples we'll see, or that metaphor is kind of lent on overly heavily and used to support a point that it shouldn't really support, doesn't have the strength to support. So our first example from Trump comes from his first interview after losing the election, talking to Maria Bartiromo.
If I wasn't here, Antifa would be running this country right now. They'd be running the country. They always like to blame the radical right. It's not the radical right. It's the radical left, and it's largely Antifa and groups like this, and nobody wants to even talk about them. Nobody wants to talk about what they're doing in Portland and what they're doing in Chicago and what they're doing in New York. And they club people over the heads when nobody's looking, and then nobody talks about it.
Wow. Wow. There's a reason that people aren't talking about this stuff. It's because it doesn't exist.
Yeah.
It's not happening.
And nobody's looking. When, you know, if you club someone over the head when no one's looking, does it make a sound?
No. When Antifa, the whole notion of Antifa, club somebody over the head.
Yeah, so Antifa would be running the country, apparently, if it wasn't for Trump. Antifa, of course, is not an organisation.
No.
It is an idea.
Yeah.
It is anti-fascism.
Yeah.
There are people who kind of identify with it strongly and you know, will carry out things in the name of Antifa, essentially, and you know, protest or, in some cases, commit violence. It isn't an organisation, but it is held up, it is kind of suggested as an organisation by the right wing, by Trump especially. It's imbued with intent and an organised system of things that they want to happen or things that they do as a group. When, in fact, I think Trump tried to get it designated as a terrorist organisation, which is difficult.
Yeah.
For many reasons. The two main ones being they're not terrorists and it isn't an organisation.
Yeah, it's just a large concept that kind of this notion of people who are against fascism, who are anti-fascists. He's tried to make them into a thing. He's tried to concretify them, you know, get them to become a thing. It's like the end of Ghostbusters, where they go, yeah, clear your mind, and then they go, ah, the demon has been named, and, you know, the Stay Puft Man arrives. So this concept of the end of the world becomes personified. They concretify it, if Marshmallow could be called concrete, into a thing. It's like a straw man. The whole Antifa thing is to create a man-shaped thing out of this concept so that you can then say, well, they are bad, they would be doing this. It's a useful tool on the part of somebody trying to coalesce protest against something by coalescing people who are against you into one big mob, and so there's this thing that will hit people over there for the club. Yeah.
Yeah, you ascribe them those negative connotations and negative activities, and that means that all or many of the people who are against you, you can accuse of being part of this organization that is, you've already proved by saying it previously, generally negative and criminal and problematic. So, yeah.
Yep.
So our second example comes from a time when there were some forest fires and Trump sat down with some scientists and forestry people and talked to them, which was just ill-advised from the get-go, really.
And we're seeing this warming trend make our summers warmer, but also our winters warmer as well. So I think one area of mutual agreement and priority is vegetation management. But I think we want to work with you to really recognize the changing climate and what it means to our forests and actually work together with that science. That science is going to be key, because if we ignore that science and sort of put our head in the sand and think it's all about vegetation management, we're not going to succeed together protecting Californians.
Okay. It'll start getting cooler.
You just watch. I wish science agreed with you.
Hey, well, I don't think science knows, actually. Tom?
God, what a frustrating person to have a conversation with. Just, I mean, the guy is just desperately saying, we really, really need to listen to the collected work of the scientists in this area and what this is telling us, all of the information that has been gathered by people who are experts and know what they're talking about. And his response is just like, yeah, they don't know anything. Science doesn't know anything, or doesn't know what I know.
Yeah, exactly. And it will get cooler. Yeah, it'll get cooler, you know, and I don't think science knows. The fact that all of these collected people around the table are saying all of this stuff, and then all he does is dismiss it by making it into one person. He makes it into a person who he can out-opinion. So, you know, science doesn't know. I know. It's going to get cooler. Believe me, I don't think science knows.
Science doesn't know, absolutely. Thomas Massie, the Republican representative who is kind of making a run at Louis Gohmert for being the stupidest congressperson, it's just he's an awful, awful person, and also an idiot. And he tweeted, "You mustn't question Fauci, for he is science."
There you go. Yeah.
And accompanied that with a kind of meme, I guess, a picture of a hand pressing down on people, with a quote saying, "To learn who rules over you, simply find out who you are not allowed to criticize." And then it says Voltaire.
It isn't Voltaire, but yeah, there we go. Yeah.
And Fauci. Yeah. Isn't science. You also are allowed to criticize him.
Yeah.
Nothing has happened to anyone who has criticized him. What you're discouraged from doing is criticizing him if you know shit all about what you're talking about.
Yes, exactly, yeah.
Because he knows what he's talking about,
yeah.
And you will lose, like Rand Paul has found out time and time and time again.
And actually, Fauci works in the discipline whereby it encourages criticism. When you kind of say, oh, actually, I think what you've done, the scientific method that you've applied there doesn't hold up, or I think the results that you've got don't actually lead from the experiment that you're doing, or let me go and do your experiment and repeat it and see if I get the same results, and that kind of stuff. But you must question Fauci.
Absolutely.
If he is science, because he's a scientist, but you can only question him on the same basis.
You
can only say, I don't think your scientific method works because I've repeated your experiment and I can't get the same results. I think somehow there's a problem there. You know, if you're an idiot, if you're an awful idiot, you can't just kind of criticize him for that.
Yeah, Massey's tweet is quite a good example of fractal wrongness. Because, first of all, Fauci isn't science, because that's nonsense. Science isn't a thing. It's a method of finding stuff out. And you absolutely not only can, but must, criticise the results of what has been found out through the scientific method, because that's how science is done.
Yeah.
As you said, it's all about, science is all about scientists critiquing each other's work, trying to replicate it or prove it wrong. And that happens frequently, and it's part of the peer review process that is key to the journals that are all about science and showing the outcome of the scientific process.
Yeah.
Also, in the fractal wrongness of this tweet, his quote from Voltaire, the "to learn who rules over you, simply find out who you're not allowed to criticise," is not from Voltaire at all.
No.
It is actually from, or kind of a similar thing, is from a guy called Kevin Alfred Strom, who is a convicted paedophile and American neo-Nazi. So not quite what he was going for in quoting respected thinker Voltaire.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Well, it's that other internet meme, isn't it? Where it says you can't trust anything you read on the internet. And then it says Henry VIII.
Yeah. So in the Trump example, when he says science doesn't know, actually the forestry guy kind of did it a little bit as well, because he was talking about science,
right,
saying, you know, that this, we have to work with the science. And in that respect, he was talking about we have to understand the outcome of the scientific method, that the output of all the work that the scientists have been doing in this area. That's fine, because he was using it in that context. When Trump said it'll get cooler out of nowhere and based on nothing, he said, I wish science agreed with you, which is possibly taking it then a little bit too far, because it's suggesting science can agree.
Yeah, yeah.
But arguably he's still using it in the sense of you know, I wish that the collected work of all of the scientists in the area, you know, was backing up what you're saying. It doesn't.
Yeah, which is the short version of that is the science. Yeah. I wish that the science could back that up.
Yeah.
And so in a way, he kind of lets Trump in.
Yeah, so when Trump then says, well, science doesn't know, suggesting that science can know stuff. And I think as Dara O'Brien, the Irish stand-up, said, when people say science doesn't know everything, when they're trying to kind of argue in favour of homeopathy and stuff like that, Dara O'Brien said, yeah, well, science knows it doesn't know everything, otherwise it would stop.
Yeah.
Because the scientists who are doing the science think there's still lots of stuff we want to find out.
Yep, exactly.
And now is the time, I think, for Mark's British Politics Corner.
So what I've chosen this week is actually this idea, the concrete idea of that unelectability is a thing, which came from the whole Corbyn project, as it's now called, the fact that there was this notion that Corbyn was unelectable. There was this thing called unelectability, and Corbyn had it. And everybody said it, despite the fact that he won two leadership contests. So the first Labour Party leadership election that was held in 2015, when he was a late addition to the roster of candidates, he won by 251,417 votes. Basically got 59% of the vote and became the leader. So like a year later, there was a vote of no confidence in his leadership. So there had to be another leadership election because they disagreed with his stance and basically socialism. There was a vote internally in the Labour Party, there was a vote of no confidence in his leadership, and there was another contest that ran. Corbyn ran in it. Owen Smith ran too, and he led this opinion that Corbyn was unelectable.
Owen Smith, the leader's former work and pensions policy chief, joined Angela Eagle in saying that they believe the current leader, much criticised amid the Brexit referendum fallout, is unelectable.
He is not a man who can lead us into the next election and win for Labour, and working people in this country cannot afford to have a Labour Party that isn't presenting a powerful opposition and a credible alternative government.
He also added, incidentally, that Corbyn would be actively deselecting those people that didn't agree with him rather than uniting the party, which is a fate that actually befell Corbyn himself under Keir Starmer's leadership. David Miliband, who was often described as the leader that the Labour Party never had and should have had, he concurred with this, but with odd timing, because after the votes in the leadership 2016 election were already cast, he wrote an article in the New Statesman, which was reported by Sky News.
Amidst this wrangling, the man often described as Labour's lost leader has written in the New Statesman why he thinks Jeremy Corbyn is unelectable. He says, nationalisation cannot be the answer to everything. Anti-austerity speeches cannot explain everything. Corporate taxation cannot pay for everything. It doesn't add up. It wouldn't work. People are not stupid.
Well, the timing of David Miliband's intervention is interesting. He can't influence the vote. The ballot's already closed. He must know that Jeremy Corbyn looks set to win. So all he can really achieve is add to this narrative that even though Jeremy Corbyn might win twice in 2 years, there are those in the party who will continue to fight against his leadership.
And in fact, he did win twice in 2 years, because he won that time with 313,000. So he increased the vote and increased the percentage to 61%, so he was even more of a leader this time. And incidentally, that was despite the fact that the Labour National Executive Committee discounted 130,000 new members that had joined simply to vote Corbyn in as leader again. So they kind of discounted that. So I'm beginning, you know, at this point, I'm beginning to think there's a conspiracy going. Mm-hmm. So the problem with this unelectable thing, this kind of, you know, reification of unelectable, the media, which is possibly another reification, followed the narrative. And on the 25th of September 2016, Jonathan Pye, who's our favourite fictional journalist, summed it up in this clip.
Here we go again. It's fucking Groundhog Day, isn't it? Jeremy Corbyn is elected Labour leader and I'm stood here saying, oh, it won't last long. What do you mean they can't win? What? Who decided he's unelectable? Who decided that? I'll tell you who, Tim, the media. We did. The same media that decided Owen Smith was a better choice for Labour leader. Apparently, being a Blairite still makes you electable, still is a vote winner. And this is what this is about. It's not about electability, it's about missing the good old days. The good old spin-doctoring, warmongering, bush-filleting, Tory-imitating good old days. You know, the new Labour good old days. Fuck integrity, fuck honesty, we just want power.
That's quite interesting, because I think actually within that little rant there, the good old days is another reification, which is also contained in when America was great and when Britannia ruled the waves.
Yeah, in a sense, there's an abstract concept that has been given these specific attributes.
Yeah.
I think there's an interesting kind of exception to this fallacy or the problematic element of making abstract ideas concrete, which is when everyone agrees to it.
Aha,
is how you get things like kind of international borders,
right,
which are completely abstract and nonsense. You know, the land on one bit of the border is the same as if you just walk across the line. But because we all go, yeah, all right, there's a border there, even though there isn't.
Yeah.
Everyone accepts it, and that's okay. It makes it not a problem, not a fallacy.
That's interesting, because I think that's possibly at the heart of the problem with the Northern Ireland peace agreement, which says that there would be no border between Northern Ireland and the Republic of Ireland, and that the fact that the Republic of Ireland is in the EU perforce means there will be a border between Northern Ireland, which is in the UK, and the UK isn't in the EU, and the EU. And I think that at the basis of the argument that the UK government, who drew up the Northern Ireland peace agreement and drew up the agreement that there would be a hard border because of the EU, they are treating the Northern Ireland peace accord border as a fallacy, as a reification of something that doesn't exist, and they're laying that at the feet of the EU.
Yeah, the island to Northern Ireland is absolutely a great example of a border that only exists because we all say yes, it exists. Because since the Good Friday Agreement, there's so many roads in Ireland, Republic of Ireland to Northern Ireland, where there's absolute, you wouldn't know basically unless you looked. There was a sign, you know, there's nothing there. There's no border guard. There's no wall. There's nothing to tell you the difference between those two stretches
of road. That was the nature, the basis of the peace accord was there would be no hard border. So there's just a notional border, and everybody agreed that until such time as the UK withdrew from the EU, and then they're kind of going, well, we don't agree with that, and again, well, wait a minute, so there we go. So and I think that the Jonathan Pye goes on actually to kind of counter the reification fallacy by pointing out that not everybody agrees with this notion that Corbyn is unelectable.
The media have spent the last 12 months telling people who voted for Jeremy Corbyn that they were wrong. How fucking entitled is that? Jeremy Corbyn is fighting the entire media class, and he just won. So instead of saying that he is unelectable, why don't Labour MPs use all their energies to prove that he is electable? Don't assume that the electorate is incapable of being persuaded or inspired. Have some faith that people can believe in something different or better. Who gets to decide if Jeremy Corbyn is electable? I'll tell you who, the electorate.
Incidentally, when Theresa May called the general election in 2017, Corbyn achieved the largest gain in the general election by the Labour Party since 1945.
I mean, some of that was Corbyn. A lot of it was Theresa May being absolutely
exactly. Well, quite. And I'll go on to expound my theory further. Yeah. So my question is, did it become a necessary self-fulfilling prophecy to get the Labour Party back to the good old days by losing the general election in 2019? Very possibly. Don't know, but Theresa May won it for Corbyn in 2017 because she was awful, and because of she tried to present basically the Brexit deal withdrawal agreement wasn't Brexity enough, and I'll go on to maintain that in itself is a reification, wasn't Brexity enough for the Tory party, and that's why they didn't like it, and that's why they got rid of her, that's why they kind of went, well, you know, fuck you. And she went, right, we'll have a general election. And everybody went, no, we've fucking had enough of you. And Corbyn, you know, increased the thing. And at one point, and the number of seats in the House, there were 635 Conservative candidates in the House, 631 Labour candidates. So it was really close. That was the point at which they should have all listened to Jonathan Pye, got behind Corbyn and gone, right, let's maximise this, just keep going. But nah. So I think, so whilst Theresa May won it for Corbyn, what did for Labour in 2019 was Labour's indistinct stance on Brexit, I think.
Yeah, definitely.
And the Tories promised to get Brexit done, which I think contains two, possibly even three, reifications. Brexit, done, and get. Like they're things that exist concretely enough to be able to be applied to one another.
I think it's hard to argue that Brexit is a reification only in as much as I'm not clear what attributes anyone has been consistently claiming Brexit would have. It's remained a completely abstract concept.
Yes, quite. But on that very basis, then the concretization of getting that done is,
I suppose,
it's a rarefication.
Claiming it's concrete enough to actually be able to do it.
that it could be done, and that you could get the doing of it completed. You could get
that
this amorphous blob.
Point, yeah.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. Yeah. Yes. It's it kind of struck me to that. Yeah. So, and in fact, in his pre-December 2019 general election campaign, Boris said as much and added some more.
On day one of the new parliament in December, we will start getting our new deal through so we get Brexit done in January. We take back control of our money so we can spend millions more every week on the NHS or whatever priorities we want, hundreds of millions. We can take back control of our borders. We can take back control of our laws so we can do things in our own way, do things differently and better. This country is aching to move on. And let's unleash the potential of this country.
So amongst the reification of things, I think such things as control, money, borders, laws, things better, differently, and which, or there's another incomplete comparison, we can do things better and differently, better than what, different from what. And then this country is aching. It's the fact that the country, so is it like a tooth or an ardent lover? And also unleash the potential, like potential is a thing that can be leashed.
I think there's an interesting mixture in there, because I think some of them, like the unleash the potential and things like that, are clearly rhetorical. I think that there's some things in there, like money and borders, which are abstract things, and laws, which are abstract things that we all agree have a meaning.
Yeah.
And I think the best example in there probably is control. The suggestion that taking back control, and control was something that we didn't have, like it was a thing that the EU had taken from us or had, and we wanted it. And it was just... Yeah. It was all that was always bullshit. It was always an abstract thing of you know, control over. We always had control over our laws and things like that.
What we didn't have was a centralized control, because the question was always, that was unasked, was, well, who's taking back control? And it turns out it's our government. You know, so they want to be able to control the borders such that they can control immigration. They want to be able to control money such that they don't have to pay tax on offshore accounts, etc., etc., all that kind of stuff. So anyway, so where are we now with this getting Brexit done? We're 2 years on. Well, now we have a Minister for Brexit Opportunities, which I think is a rarefaction too, if not an oxymoron, as there are as if there are identifiable things called opportunities or benefits which are out there that we all agree on, that aren't just movable figments of our imagination that get called opportunities or benefits in a kind of retrofit, ergo propter hoc kind of way. So, for instance, and here's a good example. In answer to the then Chief Secretary, this is the 31st of January, he may not be in office anymore. In answer to the then Chief Secretary of the Treasury, Simon Clark, on 31st of January, LBC Talk Radio, Nick Ferrari points out the retrofitting.
I think that the biggest single benefit came in the form of the vaccination programme, where we were able to use our domestic regulation system to act more quickly in terms of both procuring vaccines, but also then getting them safely licensed for use than the EU.
So the highlight of all of that then, Mr. Clark, is the fact that 155,698 people sadly died in this country of COVID, and that saved your Brexit deal, really, isn't it? Because without that, you wouldn't have much to point to.
So I think that, you know, this kind of the notion that there are Brexit benefits and we are unleashing the country's potential and taking back control sufficient to go find them is a reification of whatever they are. There's no agreement. I mean, we're back to the problem of, say, I think it's a reification because they're just abstract things. We've no idea what they are until somebody gathers them up and puts them in the bag marked Brexit benefits. There's no agreement ahead of time, so maybe that doesn't make it a ratification as to what the benefits were. They're now scrabbling around to find them.
Yeah, I think opportunities is a telling word to choose, because what it just makes me think of is people saying, you know, a problem is just an opportunity. You know, and it's just another word. It's a word that people use when they want to make something shit sound better.
Yeah. Well, that whole TV show that was in the 60s and 70s, Opportunity Knocks, is a reification in itself, isn't it? Opportunity isn't sufficiently...
It doesn't have knuckles.
The ability is... exactly. Or know where a door is. Yeah. Mm. Quite.
No one can see that we're pulling wool over their eyes, and we're all as bad as each other as we tell our lies. Oh, all of the people around him are trying to save their job. Let me state that with Boris, they're shafting us with a massive knob. These welfare policies give me huge inconsistencies. These welfare policies fuck up every logical thing. These welfare policies give me huge inconsistencies. These welfare
Sister Sledge there, of course, with their possible reification disco hit, We Are Family.
I feel like you started high there. And went, no, fuck it, I'm sticking with this.
Yeah, just going for it. Yeah. Uh-huh. And then I discovered the pitch shifter. Yeah, which allowed me to bring it down a bit, but not until I'd sung it. Yeah. There we go.
So in the fallacy in the wild, we like to talk about the fallacy of the week from a non-political perspective. And this week, our first example comes from the Mothman Prophecies, which is a kind of 2000s, early 2000s kind of Richard Gere horror. Not very good.
Yeah, it's got Richard Gere in it.
Yeah. Well, he's done some good stuff, but no, this wasn't one of them. And this is fairly early on in the film. He's just found out that his wife's got brain cancer. Not really a spoiler. And he says this to his friend.
It's like one day you're just driving along in your car and the universe just points at you and says, ah, there you are, a happy couple. I've been looking for you.
So this idea that the universe has some form of agency and intent and like has it in for you, basically, in some way.
Yeah.
This is similar to the Secret, that bullshit idea that you just kind of put your desires out into the cosmos and the cosmos, the universe, will answer you, will give you what you want. Yeah, this is absolutely reification. It's giving this abstract thing, this amorphous thing that we call everything, the name we have for all of the stuff.
Yeah. The absence of nothing
is actually a thing that can do stuff, that can have an impact on your life. Yeah.
It feels a bit like Antifa and science. This notion that you can gather all of the whole of everything, and then you go, well, yeah, you see that guy over there, he is the universe. What, the one that's pointing at us going, I can see you, that's the universe, that's what, everything, absolutely everything in existence. Since the beginning of time, this time round, that one almost allows you to give up any personal responsibility. you kind of just go, yeah. Oh, you see, it's that, it's them guys, it's that thing.
Yeah, I mean, and it's kind of interchangeable in a way with fate or destiny that kind of stuff. It's just saying that these things are happening to you, and it does stop you from taking responsibility or just accepting that things happen. That's what time is. It's just all it is separating all the things that happen so they don't all happen at once.
Yeah, and it's not to be held to blame. Yeah.
So our second example comes from the 1989 underwater horror film Leviathan. Yeah. Basically, it's a kind of the thing underwater, in a way. There's a group of scientists, and they encounter a creature which appears to be the result of genetic experiments on humans.
Somebody's been screwing around, Doc. Just take a look at that hand. I mean, look at the size of it. If you were tampering with genetics, why stop with the base model? Why not try to alter the human form? Homo aquaticus, a man who could live underwater. Think of the possibilities. Regeneration. The ability to withstand extreme cold, pressure. I mean, just think of it. Undersea mining, underwater farming.
So what's next, Doc? I mean, what if we run out of airplanes one day? What are we going to do? Just grow a whole bunch of bird people?
Natura non confundenda est. Loosely translated, don't fuck with Mother Nature.
So, yeah, as Richard Crenna says there, don't fuck with Mother Nature.
Yeah.
And this is a thing, again, common in stories from Frankenstein and probably even before that, of... Don't play God, don't fuck with Mother Nature, because it will. Nature, Mother Nature, will fuck you back, will cause you problems if you try and do that.
We shouldn't go down the science corridor too much, because that goes too far away from Mother Nature, and Mother Nature knows best.
Yeah.
And if you embrace science, then that's not what Mother Nature intended.
Yeah, absolutely. There's a mix with the appeal to nature, fallacy, obviously.
Yeah.
But yeah, this is suggesting that Mother Nature, that nature as a whole, has some...
It's a thang.
Has some intent, has some plan in some way. And yeah, if you deviate from it, if you mess with it, if you try to do things that are against nature, bad things will happen to you. Which ignores the fact that we've been messing with nature basically since we invented agriculture or domesticated wolves.
And tamed horses, grew cows.
Yeah.
Yeah. Made orange carrots.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah. The bananas that you have in your fruit bowl are a result of centuries of messing with Mother Nature.
Yeah.
Through selective breeding and...
Except the EU would make you have bent bananas.
Yeah, of course.
Yeah.
We're just doing it in a different way now than we have before. And the fact that we're doing it, that nature is, it doesn't suggest nature wouldn't be happy about it and will come and get us, as this film and many others seem to suggest.
Many others. Every single bloody film. Exactly. Except for Guillermo del Toro, who's also obsessed with underwater creatures.
Uh-huh.
He kind of, he plies the other furrow, which actually the guys that want to mess with nature and, you know, grab the underwater freaky person, they're always the bad guys. A bit like E.T., isn't it? You know, E.T. is the wonderful world of outer space nature, mm-hmm. and the bad guys that want to mess with nature, they're bad because they want to mess with nature.
Yeah.
And they have jangly keys and you never see their faces. Yeah.
So our next example comes from stand-up comedian Stephen Wright. This is from his excellent stand-up album, I Have a Pony.
I have a map of the United States, it's actual size. It says 1 mile equals 1 mile. When people ask where I live, I say E5. Last summer I folded it.
So good.
So this is basically kind of representing an offshoot, a subset of this fallacy which can be referred to, has been referred to as mistaking the map for the territory.
Nice.
What you do in this part of reification is turning the model that is a simplification of something into something more concrete, assuming it's a perfect version of what you're talking about, or just kind of arguing against the model rather than arguing against the thing itself. So like the Rutherford model of the atom, the planetary model, where you have the kind of nucleus and then these electrons kind of whizzing around in orbit. That's not what an atom looks like. That's just a kind of useful idea of how the kind of the parts of the atom are separated and stuff. And there are more detailed models which are more representative of what atoms look like. There's Niels Bohr's model with the different heights of orbit, essentially, if you want to talk about like that. There's an electron cloud model where it's more kind of quantum physics based, and there's a probability of where the electrons might be at any given time rather than specific positions and stuff. But each of these models are useful for different things, for looking at it in different ways or for doing particular experiments. Rutherford's model is quite a simple one. It's easy to understand. It's visual and interesting. But if you wanted to argue about what atoms are actually like, using that model as the thing you're arguing against wouldn't be a very good idea. And maps, by their nature, because they're a lot smaller than the place they are mapped, are necessarily simplified. The only way you can get a map that is as detailed as the territory it is a map of is to make it one-to-one, like Stephen Wright's map.
Well, it's made me think of the London Underground map, the tube map.
Yeah, it's a great example.
Yeah, because it's not that shape. The original picture of it wasn't the same shape as certainly not the same size, because you can fit it in your wallet, but it's not the same shape as the way that the stations are laid out across London. It's just a convenient diagrammatic representation, which is quite memorable and recognisable, and you can kind of see where everything goes, and it's basically around north and south and east and west. But that's why it's always surprising when people publish on the internet, if the underground map was actually where the stations actually were, it would look like this.
Yeah.
And you think, oh my God, that's completely unnavigable.
Yeah.
But
it's a really useful and an incredibly, like, brilliantly simple version.
Mm.
And it's useful specifically for navigating the tube network. It's if you tried to use it to walk between stations above ground, it's terrible.
Yeah.
When you work in central London or live in central London, you figure out pretty quickly that the relationship between the stations on the tube map bears very little resemblance to actually where they are
in
reality. So
it's kind of when you pop up out of a tube station, you go, oh, that's how all the streets join up.
It's right there.
It's right there. Why did I go from Covent Garden to Holborn?
So that's a great example. And this thing of kind of mistaking the model for the thing itself, mistaking the map for the territory. An example I kind of toyed with talking about with Trump was defund the police, because the model for defunding the police, the idea, the concept, is actually not what the name suggests. Kind of the reality of it is reducing funding for police organizations and kind of police departments and putting that funding into more upstream things which will prevent crime over time. Yeah. Or help, you know, people dealing with mental health issues or dealing with kind of, you know, inner city youth clubs and things like that, things that will actually have an impact that will mean those police are not needed. But it's simplified to the phrase defund the police.
Yeah.
And the argument that comes often from the right and from Trump and people like that is defund the police means take money away from police. That's bad.
So there will be no policing. Yeah.
Yeah, they're arguing against the model, the idea, the concept, without engaging with the reality of it, the actual territory of what would happen if we went down that route.
It's similar to the issue that Priti Patel constantly fights with, which is the immigrants in small boats coming across the channel. The model is there are immigrants coming across the channel, but it's our well-worn phrase, which we haven't used sometime. It's a bit more complicated than that. You know, it is, and that's the model that they use. Well, it's the whole, in my kind of researching this in British politics, came across the notion of immigration. There's this kind of reification of immigration as a terrible thing, but you know, Mr. Patel who works in the corner shop. Yeah, we like him, and the guy that you know works down the building site, and you know, some of my best friends are immigrants, kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. Individuals are fine, but the notion of immigrants as a thing is weaponized for political ends. So the people in small boats coming across the ocean become baddies rather than the victims of wars that they're fleeing from, traffickers that are promising them things that they can't deliver and exploiting them for money and endangering their lives. That's a lot more nuanced and complicated than just saying, here's the immigrant problem, which gets Nigel Farage down there and saying, look, there are immigrants overrunning our country. And you go, well, they're not doing any of that. It's just it's a useful model that doesn't stand up to scrutiny in the real world. You can't use the map for the territory. Exactly.
So we're gonna play
fake news, folks. I love the game. It's a great game.
I understand the game as well as anybody.
Yes, it's time for fake news, the game where I read out three Trump quotes, two of which are real and one I made up, and Mark has to figure out which one is fake news.
I'm feeling this week that the higher power is really looking out for me, and fundamentally luck is going to be a lady tonight.
This week,
yep.
These examples come from one of Trump's kind of calls to Fox and Friends.
Oh, okay.
He started doing that again.
Oh, God.
So this is a recent one. This is just from last week.
Is that because he's got nothing to do, you think?
Probably, yeah. I mean, it may also be that he's trying to kind of get his mind off some stuff that he's going through at the moment.
Yeah, could be. Yeah, things that aren't working for him particularly.
Things, not going that great. Yeah. But yeah, he called Fox and Friends. Ostensibly, he spent some of the time talking about his book, his picture book that he's done, the one that someone else took the photos and he wrote the captions for. It turned into a thing that where he was just kind of going through the old things about how great he was as a president and how terrible Joe Biden is.
Right.
Statement number one, everyone knows it's not possible that Joe Biden, Sleepy Joe, got that many votes. I had more votes than any other president ever, not even close. They said I needed 65 million. Very respected poll guy said I needed 65 million and I couldn't lose. I got 74 million and really I got a lot more than that. You just have to look at the crowds, the enthusiasm. We had crowds like nobody's ever seen, going right back to the inauguration.
Mm-hmm. Very respected poll guy. Yeah. Yeah. See, the problem was Joe got more than 74. That's the problem. It doesn't matter how many you get. The fact that you got more than you did before, more than the very respected poll guy said you needed to get, other people voted for the other guy in greater numbers.
Statement number two.
Mm-hmm.
We were 3 weeks away from finishing the wall after going through 2.5 years of lawsuits with the Democrats and winning them all. We were 3 weeks away from, think of it, finishing the wall, which is largely, frankly, finished anyway. It's a tremendous help. We had the best numbers in the history of our country on the southern border. Very little was coming in. Very few people were coming in other than coming in legally.
A nice bit of accelerated truth there. 2.5 weeks, 3 weeks away. Think of it. Finished the war, which is finished anyway. Yeah. Little was coming in other than those that were coming in. Okay. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Uh-huh. Uh-huh. Mm-hmm. Okay.
And statement number three, they view it as a romantic period, I think. And I think that's why it's doing so well, because there's a lot of romance to the book. Despite all the vicious hoaxes and scams that they pulled and made up stories like Russia, 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 you know, you had the Mueller, you had impeachment hoax number one, impeachment hoax number two. Despite all of that, they view it as a very glamorous time because our country was doing so well.
Who's they? Illiterate, blind people who weren't born then? I don't know. Okay. Yeah, had all that. Okay, the made-up stories. Mm-hmm. Very glamorous. Glamorous? Right. Okay. Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, I quite like Very Respected Pole Guy. That sounds very Trump-like. Okay. The one that I think is a bit too Jim is The Accelerated Truth in number two. But then that could... Oh, God. And then the list of things, vicious hoaxes and scams. Russia. Okay. I think number two is the one that you made up.
Okay. And of the other two, which are you more convinced by?
I think by The Very Respected Pole Guy, so number one.
Okay.
Yeah.
And number one.
Yeah.
Is.
Yeah.
Fake news.
Oh, what? That's excellent. Very respected pole guy. Got me.
Yeah, that was
got me.
That was the.
That's brilliant.
Yeah.
Nice.
Very respected pole guy.
Very respected pole guy. Said I needed that. Couldn't lose. I got more than that. Just have a look at the crowd. Oh, what? No, see, that's far too convincing. That's. Yep. Yeah. Yeah. He's going to be. After the midterms, he's going to need a speechwriter. I think you could do it. You could do it. No, utterly convinced, that one. Bloody hell. Haven't been, that's not happened for a long time. Where I've kind of binned one of them and they're going, that one I'm really convinced by. Because that's the thing. You see, yeah, that's the one I think you made up. Okay, which one are you convinced by then? And then that one turns out to be the fake one. That's, wow. That's very good.
There you go. What? So, yeah, the 3 weeks away from finishing the wall.
No! So that accelerated truth is actually true. Real. Oh, God.
We were 3 weeks away from finishing the wall after going through 2.5 years of lawsuits with the Democrats and winning them all. We were 3 weeks away from, think of it, finishing the wall, which is largely, frankly, finished anyway. It's a tremendous help. We had the best numbers in the history of our country on the southern border. Very little was coming in. Very few people were coming in. Other than coming in legally.
See, I think, so that's a big enough, that's a gym-sized joke, that is, isn't it? Best numbers, we had the best numbers in the history of a country. About what? That's kind of unfinished, uncompleted comparison.
Best.
Yeah, the best numbers, best numbers. Like five, that's the best number, isn't it? And very little was coming in, very few people coming in, other than coming illegally. So that's a gym-sized joke, but we realised that that's the structure of his speeches are kind of little jokes that he has no idea are funny.
Yeah.
That are all joke, yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, and obviously it's all bullshit as well. I mean,
oh, yeah, no, absolutely.
It goes without saying. three weeks away, 2.5 weeks away from finishing the wall.
Yeah.
They obviously, 4 years it was in.
Yeah.
They did 450 miles of wall.
Yeah.
Of which 80 miles was new wall.
Mm.
The rest was just replacing old fencing.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, it's frankly, it's finished. It's frankly finished.
Yeah.
You know, largely, frankly,
so,
finished. Anyway.
I mean, at that rate, it would have taken, another 12, 15 years to finish.
At least three terms in office. Yeah.
To be fair, to Steelbot him.
Right.
A lot of that time might have been kind of, figuring out what kind of wall to put up and stuff like that. So by the time they actually got to construction itself, it probably sped up. So maybe we're only talking another 2 or 3 years. But two and a half, 3 weeks is possibly a little bit ambitious.
And did they win all the lawsuits with the Democrats?
They didn't really win all the lawsuits, no. The Supreme Court... I mean, not really. Let's say this. At the point where Biden became president in January 2021, the Supreme Court then kind of dismissed, because it was now moot, a pending suit about whether... from basically, Congress was suing based on Trump's appropriation of money from the military budget, which was designed to combat drug trafficking and stuff like that. And so he kind of tried to take money from the military budget to put into wall construction, and Congress said, you can't do that. You need congressional approval through the appropriations process.
Right.
And the Supreme Court were kind of scheduled to hear an appeal from Trump because the lower courts had said he wasn't allowed to do it and Congress were allowed to sue him about it. Supreme Court was kind of waiting to hear. Biden got in, halted construction of the wall.
Yeah.
And at that point, the Supreme Court, well, there's no point getting us to make a decision about this. So the suit was dropped, essentially. So he didn't win it, but he had lost it. He'd lost it in lower courts, and it didn't get decided by the Supreme Court. So
when he says we won them all...
Yeah, that's definitely not true.
Neither of them applicable. Yeah.
Also, part of the narrative of Biden's open borders has been the enormous amount of drugs and people who are coming in illegally over the borders. If Trump's wall worked as he claimed it would, and it was frankly largely finished, how are they getting in?
Other than coming in legally.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Either
the best numbers,
it wasn't finished and there are large parts of the border that are completely unwalled and people are getting in that way in record numbers, or it was finished and the wall doesn't work. Or it was finished, the wall works, and Biden hasn't been having an immigration problem. You can't have it both ways.
No, can't have all of it. Exactly. Yes. Yeah. So they kind of go, we were 3 weeks away from finishing the wall. So if we'd only finished the wall, there would be no problem. And yet we finished the wall and we had the best numbers.
Also, he's claiming that the best numbers that he had are because of the amount of wall he put up.
Yeah.
So
80 miles of it.
Biden hasn't taken any wall down.
Yeah,
so
exactly. So where are they? They're going round the end of the wall. That's what it is, because it's not wide enough.
It doesn't make no sense whatsoever. That's the problem.
No, there was a drama on the radio about Hadrian's Wall, and it's kind of like a comedy. Not very good, but the funniest bit was, I'm going to build a wall that goes from coast to coast to stop people coming in, and then the Pict or the Scot just said, well, let's just go around the end in a boat.
Yeah.
There you go. Oh, yeah.
Statement number three about his book and about people viewing his presidency as a romantic, glamorous period is real.
They viewed it as a romantic period, I think. And I think that's really why it's doing so well, because there is a lot of romance to the book. It was, despite all of the vicious hoaxes and scams that they pulled and made up stories like Russia, Russia, Russia. You know, you had the Mueller, you had impeachment hoax number one, impeachment hoax number two. Despite all of that, they view it as a very glamorous time because our country was doing so well.
It's completely in La La Land, isn't he?
Yeah. Just
utterly.
Oh, yes, the glamorous first year of pandemic.
Yeah. Yeah, that romantic period, when we look back to that romantic time of Trump advocating bleach and ultraviolet light inside the body somehow. Whoa! You know, he's up there with the Kennedys, really.
What does he even mean that there's a lot of romance to the book? It's a book of pictures of stuff Trump did in the White House with captions that he's written.
That say, here like, are some
this is me with Nancy Pelosi.
This is another room. I put some
in the Lincoln bedroom.
In here. No, who's they? Who are these? It's just utterly made up. Why do they continue to give them airtime?
They might be some of the 300,000 people who he claims have bought his book.
Right.
At a cost of around $80.
Wow.
For an unsigned copy and I think $230 for a signed copy.
Or the 300,000 copies that he's sold out of various funds that people have given him in good faith, that he's just then bought his way onto the bestsellers list.
Yeah. And again, this is money that he's making for himself, obviously, from a book made up entirely of public domain photos.
Yeah.
That he didn't take.
Yeah. And he's put them in it's like one of those Well, they're kind of a cross between self-published books and those photo books that you can do,
mm-hmm.
where you just gather all your photos from your holiday and you put little captions underneath that mean nothing to anybody except you and the people yeah. that were in them. And then you've published it or you've, yeah. you put it out there and it's available on Google Prints or whatever. And you try and convince other people to buy it. And you think nobody is going to want to buy that because, A, I'm not interested. B, I've seen all the photos. And
they're literally all available on the web.
Exactly.
Instagram feed.
Yeah. They're not non-fungible tokens, you know. yeah. Yes. Oh, my God. Did you see? And the thing was, I knew that that one was real. It's just, yeah. Oh, God.
So, unfortunately, that means that you didn't get that right. And now you are back down to 50%, 42 out of 84.
God damn it.
So you better get the next one right, otherwise you're slipping down below 50% again.
Yeah. Not kind of a lady tonight was luck. No. See, never been a lady to begin with.
So it's time for the part of the show that this week at least is called Spying is Not a Logical Fallacy, because John Durham, the...
This is so bloody twisted and...
Yeah.
Oh, my God. Yeah.
Yeah. So John Durham, who was kind of hired basically to find evidence against Hillary Clinton in some way.
Yeah.
He made a filing last week,
yeah.
which was not an indictment, didn't allege or include any criminal activity whatsoever,
yeah.
Didn't say all the things that the right wing decided it said,
yeah.
But triggered an enormous outcry on the right that Trump was absolutely, definitely right and mm-hmm. and justified when he claimed that the Clinton campaign had been spying on his campaign.
Yeah, yeah.
Him specifically, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
And a little bit of background.
Yeah.
Durham, in September of last year, brought an indictment against a lawyer called Michael Sussman, a former prosecutor, a former Clinton campaign lawyer, for lying to the FBI in a in a kind of interrogation, I guess, in a deposition.
Yep.
And the lie that he supposedly told was that at the time when he was being interviewed, he didn't have any clients, basically. He wasn't working on behalf of any clients.
Right.
So whereas
he
in fact
said he wasn't, but he was.
Yeah, he said he wasn't.
Yep. Yep.
Whereas in fact he was a lawyer for the Clinton campaign.
Yep.
And possibly other clients as well. This was in a meeting with FBI agent Jim Baker, and Baker has subsequently testified to Congress that he doesn't remember what Sussman said about whether he had any clients in the meeting. He was the only person in the meeting with Sussman. There were no notes taken at the time, and the meeting wasn't recorded.
Right.
So it's almost entirely on John Durham's kind of word
that, yeah. Yeah.
that Sussman has been indicted for 1001, lying to the FBI, basically.
Right.
And subsequent to this filing,
mm-hmm.
Sussman now obviously has lawyers. He chose a huge law firm called Latham & Watkins, like the second biggest law firm, I think, in the world, certainly in the US.
Yeah.
They have about 3,000 lawyers. And the filing that Durham made late Friday night last week
mm-hmm.
was a quite weirdly called a motion to inquire about conflict of interest.
Right.
A motion to inquire isn't really a thing.
Right.
Basically, if you think that your opponent's lawyer or the defendant's lawyer has a conflict of interest,
yep.
you typically look into it. If they do, you file a motion to disqualify them as counsel
because conflict of interest.
For having a conflict of interest.
Yeah, that would be your filing. Yeah.
So what Durham filed instead was He decided he basically discovered that Latham & Watkins, this huge 3,000 lawyer firm, as a firm, other lawyers in the firm had represented people during the Mueller investigation.
Right.
They represented Perkins Coie, which is another large law firm who has also done work for Clinton, and another individual. So there's kind of, he's making the argument that because the same company had lawyers who worked for people who were involved in the Mueller probe,
right,
and other lawyers who weren't involved in that at all are now lawyers for Sussman, they may, by being part of the same firm, have right. some kind of knowledge of the other side or of stuff that was going on with the FBI at the time. Or it's there's nothing there, basically.
Right. And so the filing is asking whether he can look into it.
Essentially, yeah. He's asking the court to look into it. He's asking the court to decide whether there is a conflict of interest.
Right. So he's kind of going, there's a bit of smoke there.
Yeah. He's absolutely saying
lots of fire.
This looks odd.
Yeah. Yeah.
But the way he's done it is this kind of 13-page filing, which is kind of like it's like a narrative that he's told about the stuff that is Sussman did and stuff like that.
Right.
It includes some claims about things. Sussman went to the FBI originally in I think 2017 with information about communications between, potentially at least, the White House and Russia and Russian bank called Alpha Bank,
right,
which was a reasonable thing to do, to if and not illegal in any way.
Yeah,
the information came from a technology company who were employed to work within the executive office of the president, in the White House, and monitor their kind of potential if people had been trying to hack into their systems and things like that.
Yep.
So they were monitoring essentially DNS lookups, which isn't communication between people.
Yeah,
it's kind of digital handshakes between computers.
Right.
Yeah, you don't know what information people are getting through those or looking up or what websites they're going to or anything like that. It's just about
whether there were links connections between. Yeah.
And so the company that was monitoring this activity, ostensibly looking, in case people were hacking into the office of the president and things like that, that information was information they were entitled to have.
Right.
And in doing that, they found potentially problematic data that was connected to Russia. They, through Sussman, then gave that data to the FBI.
Right. Yep.
So that's essentially what Durham said in this, but was very vague about the kind of allegations that he was making.
Yeah.
He's got a history of being vague. His original indictment of Sussman in September was so vague about what lie he had told to the FBI that the kind of Sussman's counsel then filed a kind of specific motion. I think it's called a motion for particulars or something like that. That is basically saying, "Huh?
Yeah."
It's the kind of
tell me what you know.
What are you talking about?
Yeah.
what they were doing was asking for more information so they could even start to try and defend the thing that their client was accused of, because they didn't have wasn't detailed.
What is it you're accusing me of? Yeah.
So he has a bit of a history of kind of filing these kind of vague, smoke-filled filings. And essentially what happened next was an accelerated truth thing, where it went from this very vague set of data, which was a lot of which was already known. It was certainly known by a lot of the people who were kind of involved in the situation.
Right.
A lot of the people who ended up commenting on it. Ultimately, one of the things that kind of spoiler didn't come out and wasn't at least acknowledged by Durham's side until later was that this happened when Obama was president.
Oh,
this didn't
oh, right.
happen
when
under Trump. It was right. The firm was hired. They gathered all this data while Obama was in the Oval Office.
Right.
It kind of bled into Trump's time when he became president. So there was still some data collected after Obama left office.
Right.
Of these kind of DNS lookups and this kind of information.
Yeah.
But the suggestion that was then made by the right wing was first of all, Clinton's campaign paid for people to spy on Trump. Which she didn't pay for it. It wasn't spying, and they weren't doing it to Trump.
Yeah.
So
yes, it's a bit like the Italian Job remake, which was neither in Italy nor was there a job involved.
Yeah. So the first responses to this filing was from a reporter from the Epoch Times, Hans Manke, I think, who said, "Holy moly, new Durham filing. Rodney Joffe and his buddies at Georgia Tech monitored Trump's internet traffic while he was president of the United States." That bit's technically kind of true.
Yeah.
They didn't monitor the internet traffic as such, but they did gather data, and part of the data they gathered was at the very beginning of Trump's presidency.
Right.
The following morning, a Twitter account called Technofog tweeted, "Rodney Joffe et al., DNC/Perkins-Coie allies, exploited a sensitive US government arrangement to gather intel on the executive office of the president of the US. They spied on Trump." So again, their sensitive US government arrangement was the fact they'd been hired specifically to do this.
Yeah. Why was that sensitive? And people knew that they'd done it, so it wasn't that sensitive.
Found a thing that could possibly be criminal and alerted the criminal authorities about it.
And said, we think this might be criminal. There's people hacking the system.
Yeah.
Or the people going to places where they ought not to be going. We think that might be criminal.
Yeah.
Yeah.
About half an hour later, 11 a.m., the House Judiciary GOP account tweeted, "We knew they spied, but it was worse than we thought."
And then
by the afternoon, a conservative website, Red State, posted an article titled, "John Durham drops a shock and awe filing about spying on Donald Trump." Then Mark Meadows tweeted, "They didn't just spy on Donald Trump campaign. They spied on Donald Trump as sitting president of the United States. It's all even worse than we thought."
Wow. Yeah. you can hear it accelerating.
Yeah. Then Kash Patel issued a statement via Twitter that said, "The Hillary Clinton campaign and her lawyers..." Again, this is the first that there's anything to do with Hillary. "Masterminded the most intricate and coordinated conspiracy against Trump when he was both a candidate and later president of the United States. The lawyers worked to infiltrate Trump Tower and White House servers." So,
what?
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
So Trump Tower's been thrown in there all of a sudden.
Yeah, suddenly.
And the word infiltrate.
Yeah.
And the word infiltrate was then picked up by Fox News and repeated many times as if it was part of Durham's original filing.
Yeah.
Which it wasn't at any point.
Nope.
So by the afternoon, Trump issued a statement saying, "The latest pleading from special counsel Robert Durham," that's not his name, it's John Durham, "provides indisputable evidence that my campaign and presidency were spied on by operatives paid by the Hillary Clinton campaign in an effort to develop a completely fabricated connection to Russia."
Wow.
Which it absolutely doesn't provide any of that evidence at all. No. It doesn't even imply any of that stuff. He went on to say, "In a stronger period of time in our country, this crime would have been punishable by death."
What?
Yes.
Stronger period of time.
So not only is he claiming there's a crime which hasn't been committed. If there was a crime, Durham has the ability to indict people for crimes.
Yeah.
If anyone had done anything against the law, he wouldn't have just put this in a filing for a motion to inquire about.
Yeah. I quite like to ask some questions about this. This crime was punishable by death. What the fuck? Yeah.
So,
I've just looked up in the filing. I've just done a search for infiltrate. No.
Yeah, infiltrate doesn't exist in the filing. No. The filing that alleges this conflict of interest doesn't mention any of Michael Sussman's lawyers either. They don't come up in this filing saying Sussman's lawyers might have a conflict of interest. They're not mentioned in that.
No.
So that's weird.
Wow.
So yeah, it became this huge thing, this huge story where all of the claims that Trump had ever made about the Clinton campaign, who, by the way, no longer existed by this point.
Yeah.
The Clinton campaign stopped when she didn't get elected in 2016.
Why would they therefore pay lawyers to spy on Trump?
And obviously Fox News took it and ran with it, and it also made up their own stuff. So by that evening, Tucker Carlson said, the filing says they intercepted internet traffic, which it doesn't really. It talks about DNS records particularly. And then he says, that is emails, presumably text messages.
No. Presumably, you can text presume
messages,
what you like.
I don't think text messages aren't internet traffic anyway.
No. Don't let a few facts get in his way. Yeah.
Sean
yeah.
Hannity claimed that the Clinton campaign hacked into Trump's campaign server and the office of the president and stole material, according to the filing, which is not what the filing says at all.
No, nothing in there.
Fox News' website had an article where the headline was, Clinton campaign paid to infiltrate Trump Tower White House servers to link Trump to Russia, Durham finds. Which he did not find at all. None of that.
Not found any of that. No, it's not in the file. And it doesn't. And actually, if anything, you read the filing, it doesn't expect to find anything like that at all.
Not at all.
It's based, because if it did, it wouldn't be an inquiry, a motion to inquire. It's going, I think you should look into this conflict of interest here, this possible conflict of interest, because this company employed lawyers who are now working on something else.
Yeah, that is all.
That's it. That's all they're doing.
Yeah. And later that week, Durham basically issued a statement that said something like, some media sources have overblown the claims. It's not my fault. I didn't do anything. If journalists can't be trusted to do their own work, then, that's up to them. So he kind of really was distancing himself. So he was a kind of saying, the stuff that's been claimed since isn't true, but without saying it, and kind of taking pains to claim it was nothing to do with him if people wanted to believe this stuff.
Yes, exactly. So it doesn't do anything to not fan the flames.
Yeah.
He kind of, in the first bit, he's just kind of, he's done a right-wing shock jock thing by saying, I think these questions should be asked.
Yeah.
It's what his filing is, and now he's saying, I'm just asking questions. it's not my fault that people are drawing these conclusions. When what he should be saying is, I didn't say any of that. It's all made up because you've all got an agenda and that's nothing to do with what's in the filing. But no, he's just kind of, he's doing the plausible deniability thing, isn't he? He's just going, if you want to find those things in there, that's not what I wrote. No, he doesn't even say that. It's just not my fault that you're finding these things in there.
Yeah.
Your research.
It is.
Because, it is.
Because
it's
he so put fucking some funny. Of that stuff yes. in there yeah. so that yeah. it would
do exactly
cause a
that.
Kind of, yeah, yeah, it would cause yeah. a... I mean, it, none of it needed to be... First of all, he didn't need to make this filing at all. What he needed to do was contact Latham and Watkins and say, are any of the lawyers, are any of your staff members who were working on that thing now working on this thing?
Yeah.
And they would go, no, of course not. We understand conflict of interest. We're quite a big law firm.
Yeah.
But he didn't do that. He didn't contact them. Instead, he filed this bullshit filing, which isn't even a real kind of motion that people make.
Yeah.
And kind of implied some stuff in vague terms in the filing so that people would make inferences that weren't there.
What it is a 13-page QAnon drop, isn't it? Remember them? Yeah. It's that kind of a, you know, it's a huge thing with a whole bunch of hooey. We might as well have just filed a thing that just said coincidence.
Yeah, absolutely.
And left it at that. That's actually all you need to set the right-wing media aflame.
Yeah.
It's just to make some things that they will then think, typical, and then fill in the gaps.
Mm-hmm.
So he's done that. Yeah, is there a way of striking these people off like a badly
disbarring
performing
them,
yeah.
I mean, well, it's in the process of happening to people like Sidney Powell, but I don't think this isn't sufficiently problematic for the court to take an action.
I mean, at best it's
Durham,
it's poor form, it's bad something, it's bad and poor and inflammatory.
He's a bad law talking guy.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
That's about it. Yeah.
Filing a non motion full of non things in order to get a result? For what purpose?
I mean, the result essentially will almost certainly be the court will dismiss this motion.
Yes, exactly. Yeah.
Because they'll just say.
They'll just ring up the lawyers and go, have you got anybody?
Well, they won't. Yeah, they won't. The they won't lot? Look into it. They'll go, no, if you think there's a conflict of interest, look into it and then file a motion to disqualify.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Do it properly.
And of course, Fox will report in full on the fact that he hasn't found anything.
Oh, yeah.
When he was told by the court to look into it and he found nothing.
Yeah, they'll fully retract all of the claims that they've
made. Yeah. And take down all of the headlines and the ticker tape, everything. Yeah. They'll go, all of that stuff we said is all wrong. Well, if they did that, they would spend all their time doing that.
Yeah.
That's the problem with it. Yeah. We have to go on 24 hours. The second 12 hours every day,
and to be honest,
is to say that
they get
hours
so much wrong while they were correcting themselves that they then have to correct the correction.
They have to keep going.
It's just an endless loop.
It's like Borges's infinite library. Yeah, it's exactly. Uh-huh. Fractal wrongness and infinite library all in one go. And finally, some things we really don't have time to talk about.
Well, we finally know why Trump thinks you need to flush a toilet so many times to get it to work. And it's because he's been shoving evidence down there. According to a new book by New York Times reporter Maggie Haberman, White House staff periodically found Trump's toilet clogged with bits of torn up paper. Trump has, of course, denied the allegation, going with the totally plausible, there would be no way of her knowing if it were the fact. There would be no way of her understanding that or knowing it. To be honest, I think he's missed a trick here. If he claimed that Steve Bannon told him that was the best way to send his documents to the National Archives to comply with the Presidential Records Act, I think everyone would believe he's stupid enough to fall for that. After all, he was stupid enough to take 15 boxes of documents back to Mar-a-Lago, and we've learned now that some of those were clearly marked as classified and even top secret. But, you know, at least you guys didn't elect a president who had used their own personal email server for some work emails.
Could have been so much work. Yeah. Trump's all set to make America great again by making Americans even more broke again. Doubtless ringing to the tune of Let's Grift Again like we did last summer, Trump's Make America Great Again PAC cash registers have been helpfully spending $37,541.67 in each of the 10 months last year renting office space at Trump Tower. Yeah, but he needs office space to run his possible new campaign. Right, but that's all done in Florida. The so-called office space in Trump Tower is empty. He's paying himself, people, and the total $375,417 is more than the $350,500 that his Save America Committee donated last year to Republican candidates running for office. You know, the reason that the fundraising arms of Save America and Make America Great were set up. Not being campaign funds, they, of course, have no rules on how the money is spent, so that's fine by Trump. There's no signs up anywhere, being his justification for doing what the fuck he likes with it. And yes, of course, he's still one of you blue-collar workers, has only you in his thoughts and in his heart. And of course, he's not just bleeding you dry to ward off his latest in a line of fiscal meltdowns, which, of course, thankfully, are lining up to be seen in court. Noah Bookbinder, the president of Citizens for Responsibility and Ethics in Washington, said that although Trump is still using his position to funnel donors' money to himself, there's no law that says you can't use this as a scam to enrich yourself. He's allowed to do this. It's sleazy, but it's legal. Now there's a campaign slogan.
Valentine's Day can be a tough holiday for some, and there tends to be a bit of a bump in breakups around that time, maybe because people feel they're faking the romance or decide they want something more. This year, Trump's accountancy firm Mazars announced that they were splitting up with Trump, and that the Trump Organization should inform their lenders and insurers that they should no longer rely on the last 10 years of financial statements pertaining to the Trump Organization. Part of the reason for the split, according to the Mazars letter, was the January 18th filing by New York Attorney General Letitia James, detailing Trump's inconsistent valuations of various assets. While Trump was having a bad week, Letitia James was having a very good week, and on Thursday a judge ruled that she would be able to depose Trump, Don Jr. and Ivanka under oath in her civil investigation of the Trump Organization. And here's the really fun part. In a civil case, pleading the fifth can be used against you in court.
Yay! In a demonstration of how the Republicans are gentle, low-key, sensitive folk, Arizona Republican Senate candidate Jim LeMond's latest campaign ad is both, neither, nuanced and aware. The ad quietly ran at the Super Bowl and featured good old Sheriff Jim squaring up against the incoming posse of Nancy Pelosi, Joe Biden and Mark Kelly in an old-fashioned gunfight in an appeal to no doubt the gun-toting, Western-loving voting base. While Jim doesn't really cut a John Wayne figure, nor Gene Wilder in Blazing Saddles even, his playing at Cowboys shows yet again the right can't do humour. Mark Kelly's wife, former representative Gabby Giffords, was actually shot in the actual head and critically injured in a 2011 mass shooting in Tucson. Yep, the self-same state. And that also killed 6 people and injured many others. Of course, it's a dead cat tactic on the part of the Republican candidate, who can then bleat about snowflakes and wokes objecting on the basis that left-wing snowflakes can't stand the fact that for once Arizona will have a senator who will shoot straight with them and stop cowering to Biden. Yeah, 2 things. A, is anyone actually cowering to Joe? And B, if he's taking out ads at the Super Bowl and his campaign has raised only $600,000 from individual donors, he's going to run out of money, isn't he? Whilst the right will love him for his uncompromising, read, inhumane stance, no amount of dressing up as Woody is going to make him our favourite deputy.
The LA Rams won a close victory at Super Bowl 56, and the game, the ads and the halftime show were all just as much fun as usual. Unless, of course, you're a Republican. In which case, the fact that the performers in the halftime show were Kendrick Lamar, Mary J. Blige, Eminem, 50 Cent, Dr. Dre and Snoop Dogg was a racist, amoral display of criminals, and it's all just noise and you can't even tell what they're saying or something like that. Massive-headed 27-year-old senior citizen Charlie Kirk tweeted, "The NFL is now the League of Sexual Anarchy," which, if you're going to join a league, sounds like a pretty cool one.
Yep.
Honestly, it made no sense. I watched the halftime show twice, specifically looking for some sexual anarchy. I couldn't find any. Presumably, Charlie Kirk prefers celibate authoritarianism. I say presumably, he definitely would, no question. Meanwhile, Rudy Giuliani had a problem with Eminem taking a knee at the end of Lose Yourself, and many other right-wing commentators forgot Eminem was there at all, since they tweeted that it was racist to have a halftime show without a single white person in it. Finally, after the New York Post published a picture of Snoop Dogg smoking weed before going on stage, everyone had to do their best Claude Rains impression and insist they were shocked, shocked, that of all people, Snoop Dogg would smoke weed.
Well, we at Fallacious Towers can't wait to get on Truth Social, Trump's Twitter knockoff, but it looks like we might have to. Like us, the Daily Beast can't wait, but I've got to. On launch night yesterday, the app download kept giving them something went wrong, please try again messages. And then, because the app was simply so popular, due to massive demand, we have placed you on our wait list. At one point, Daily Beast reported that they were 96,427th place in line on Monday morning. Other users reported queue positions as high as 160,000. Now that's some customer services hassle right there. On Sunday, Devin Nunes, the former Republican congressman turned CEO of Trump Media and Technology Group, said that he hopes the new app will be fully operational by the end of March, which might give them time to find a new logo. many people on actual Twitter having pointed out that the Truth Social T logo is exactly the same as UK transport firm Trailar's T logo. They are consulting lawyers about the truth involved in intellectual property rights. And how much truth can Trump's system actually handle? Despite being billed as a venture to stand up to the tyranny of big tech, Trump's new platform will utilize AI sensors to police its content. The Fox Business Network, no less, reported in January that Truth had enlisted a San Francisco-based Series D startup that provides automated solutions through cloud-based artificial intelligence for understanding images, videos, and text content. Just in case people put unflattering pictures of Donnie up there, perhaps. Not that that's our intention, of course.
You've probably heard that a bunch of anti-vax truck drivers have been blocking roads in Ottawa for a couple of weeks now, and since they're science deniers and massive assholes, they have had the full support of the American right wing. Foghorn with a moustache Mike Lindell announced that as a show of support he would ship 12,000 MyPillows to the truckers, which seems a bit cruel to me as they're probably already uncomfortable enough in their trucks without having to sleep on a MyPillow. Luckily for them, the shipment has been indefinitely delayed due to the fact that Lindell was turned back at the Canadian border because he's unvaccinated. Lindell told the Daily Beast that he would get around this by using a helicopter to airdrop the pillows with little parachutes into the protest zone, but has since claimed that was a joke, probably because someone told him what happens when aircraft fly over international borders without authorization.
Well, it's kind of a half-term holiday for the British government in that they don't have to come into the House and are supposed to be spending time in their constituencies. So that's a bit less troubling on the eyes, ears and psyche, you'd think. But no. Determined to prove how popular he is and how right he is to be the one entrusted with getting things done for the country, Boris has distracted us from the fact that he is under investigation by the actual police because Partygate, by ending all restrictions for COVID, including isolating if positive and even bothering to have a test at all. Yippee! Now we won't know if any new variant arrives, so we'll be just as unprepared as we were in March 2020. Oh, and if that's not enough, he's been upping the warmongering rhetoric vis-a-vis Putin and Ukraine, with the Defence Secretary saying, well, you can't trust anything their Defence Department says. Yep, takes one to know one. The Foreign Secretary Liz Truss has been bolstering her gravitas as a likely Tory leader by dressing up as a Russian and pretending to be Margaret Thatcher. Not to be outdone by Liz riding a tank, an RAF fighter jet was flown 330 miles just so Boris could sit in it and make brum brum noises. When your country is being run by cosplay politicians, is it any wonder we're not allowed to be amongst the grown-ups in Europe or the World Health Organization? But don't worry, populism will defeat the enemies of Russia and COVID. I mean, just look at Trump.
So that's all the bad arguments and faulty reasoning we have time for this week. You'll find the show notes at fallacioustrump.com, and if you hear Trump say something stupid and want to ask if it's a fallacy, our contact details are on the contact page.
If you think we've used a fallacy ourselves, let us know. And if you've had a good time, please give us a review on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, or wherever you get your podcasts. Or simply tell one other person in person about how much they'd like our podcast. And you can support the show at patreon.com/ftrump, just like our strawman level patrons Steve Bickle, Schmutz, Mark Reiki and Amber R. Buchanan, and our true Scotsman level patrons Kaz Tui, Andrew Houck, Max Beaver and our top patron Lauren. Thanks very much everyone, we really do appreciate your support.
You can connect with those awesome people as well as us and other listeners in the Facebook group at facebook.com/groups/fallacioustrump.
All music is by The Outbursts and was used with permission. So until next time on Fallacious Trump, we'll leave the last word to the Donald.
That's right. Go home to mommy. Bye. Bye.